Hello, this is Sam Giordano, American Bankruptcy Institute Executive Director, with another edition of ABI Podcast. Our guest today is Stephen Dubner. He is the co-author with economist Stephen Levitt of the runaway bestseller Freakonomics, A Rogue Economist Explores the Hidden Side of Everything. It was on the New York Times bestseller list for about 80 weeks or so, and has done more than any other work to apply economic concepts to real-life situations to help all of us think like an economist. It's not as boring or as dangerous as it sounds. Stephen recently was the keynote speaker at ABI's author luncheon at the NCBJ annual meeting in San Francisco, where he held a packed audience captive with the economic story of how you can convince monkeys to engage in prostitution, or something close to that, among many other rogue economic truths revealed that day. So, Stephen, thanks again for the wonderful insights last month, and welcome to ABI Podcast.
Hi, Sam. Thanks for having me.
By the way, how many of these speeches to business groups and others do you and Levitt give in a given year?
Quite a few. Probably a couple, a couple a week during the season, during the fall and spring. So probably combined, the two of us, probably a little over 100 a year or so.
And, wow.
And what's nice about it is that it leads you, forces you really, to figure out how to present your material well before an audience of live people, which is, for a writer, for me as a writer, as a journalist, and for Levitt as an academic researcher, for both of us, it's really valuable because you see what people respond to. Because very often when you're trying to explain an idea or tell a story on paper in your head, it's very, the thing that's hardest about it, the reason that it's very hard to be your own editor in any arena, whether it's, a lawyer writing a brief or a writer writing a book or an academic, Levitt writing a mathematical model, is you know the story and you're trying to download it, but you need to upload it to other people and make sure that they understand it. And so when you've got a live audience and you tell a story and it's not clear, the ideas are not coming across, you know very well by how silent they are or how many are sleeping or heading for the exits. So it's really a very valuable way of, working on ideas and material, and also you just get very valuable feedback. And then for me as a writer, the most valuable piece really is getting to speak to groups of professionals well outside the realm that I as a journalist would normally travel in, and just learning a lot about these different worlds and the way things actually work in these worlds. So whether it's bankruptcy lawyers and judges or, cosmetic surgeons or whoever it may be, because that's what Freakonomics is really about, is trying to use data to kind of get beneath the surface of a particular, pursuit scenario, whatever, and figure out what's really going on instead of taking a guess at it or kind of going with the stereotype. So it's actually really valuable for those reasons.
Well, great. We're happy to add to that body of knowledge. How about the most unusual venue or audience, or maybe the most hostile audience that you or Stephen have encountered?
I wouldn't say. The funny thing about hostility is that when people pay for something, there's an idea in economics and behavioral economics called the endowment effect, which is, this grew out of some studies that are very, very, very simple. You take a bunch of undergrads, you run an experiment, and you give them, half of them coffee mugs and the other half, a pen set, and then you let them keep them for a week, and then you bring them back and offer them an exchange or a trade or a buyout, whatever. And the thing that they have owned, because they owned it, is considered more valuable to them, right? So this is a very interesting psychological effect. I noticed this years ago when I was writing a little bit about theater, and I became a Tony voter. I live in New York, and that sounds on the surface like a great thing. A Tony voter, you get free tickets to every show
right.
on Broadway, right?
Right.
The fact of the matter is 95% of the shows were terrible, but you had to go to all
right.
of them.
Right, it was a burden.
You had to vote. But when you have a free ticket, you're thinking, you can really feel free to express, at least to yourself, how bad the thing is. But if I had bought that same ticket to that same show for $75, I'm going to say, it was good. So the endowment effect is very strong. When we are brought in by a group to be a speaker, that's the endowment effect in spades there. So people who see us at an event where they've brought us in, while they might hate us if they happen to stumble across us for free on TV or on in a park, they tend to be more more generously disposed toward us. So there's not very much hostility. I would welcome it. Hostility is kind of, you know, it's a little bit of it would be fun. In terms of unusual audiences, I spoke recently before NARAL, the pro-choice group in New York City, which has to do with an argument in the book about abortion.
Right, we're going to talk about that later.
You know, some pretty unusual industry groups of industries that I barely knew existed before. Mm-hmm. And again, you know, it's really mostly for me, it's a lot of fun to try to learn about their businesses and What I learned long ago not to do is, as a speaker, not to try to bring Kohl's to Newcastle. In other words, not to try to come to talk to an industry group about their industry unless I happen to know a lot about it, because they know a lot more about it. What I'll try to do is bring some ideas that come from Freakonomics or sort of the methodology behind it and tell stories that might allow them to think in a little bit different way about their own business.
So how about the National Association of Realtors? Likened to the KKK in one of the chapters.
Yeah, the NAR hasn't invited us to come talk, although honestly it'd be really fun. They're you know, the NAR is it's interesting. They are a very interesting group in that essentially they are a cartel that represent you know, realtors who I mean, this is a long story to get into, so I won't get into it here, but essentially, we wrote about them a little bit in the book, and the comparison we made with the Ku Klux Klan was meant to be a little bit, you know, flip, not calling them killers, certainly, but it was meant to illustrate the idea of information asymmetry, which is the idea that when there are two or more parties to a transaction, if one of them holds a significant advantage in the amount of information they have, which is to say most transactions are like that, then they are at liberty to exploit that informational advantage if they so choose. And we made the comparison to show that the Klan, their informational asymmetry had to do with the violence that they could perpetrate and the way that they used secret proceedings and passwords and so on and secret alliances with law enforcement to protect that right to commit that illegal violence. The realtors basically have a lot of information in a particular transaction to the point where they know a lot more about the way a transaction will unspool than the person that they're representing, their customer. And they can, if they so choose, pretty easily exploit that to their advantage. And according to the data that we looked at, often do. Now, this doesn't make realtors bad people. It just makes them people, because the entire argument behind Freakonomics is that people respond to incentives. And if you want to understand human behavior, you need to kind of tease out what incentives are at play in a particular situation, and then you can try to measure the human behavior in response to that.
Right, right. Well, we know people over there, and we'll convince them.
Yeah, that, that'd be great.
You know, you're an okay guy.
Well,
at least you. Let me ask you, are you surprised at all by the continuing enthusiasm for the book and all the spin-offs from it? You've got a very popular blog now. Colleges are using the book in their some of their economics courses or study guides for students. I mean, it's really a whole kind of cottage industry out there of Freakonomics devotees. Are you surprised by any of that?
Yeah.
You're a rock
star.
The
short answer is very much surprised. I think every writer, when you have a new book coming out, this is my third and this is Levitt's first. So for him, you know, he now thinks this is typical. You write a book and it comes out and you sell a couple million copies and sit back and smile.
Yeah.
But that's, you know, it's a very, very anomalous occasion. And I think most writers are very excited when a given book comes out, but that period right before it, it's often called within my circle of friends, at least, we call it the lull before the lull. You are expecting something to happen, and then it doesn't. Now, if you're Stephen King, you kind of know that every book will have a splash. This one was very much a surprise, And then, as you said, it's taken on all different kinds of other forms. So there's some film and TV stuff being worked on and all this other stuff. What's nice about it is that even though we kind of, you know, created this thing, whatever you call it, a brand or an idea, whatever, it's very, very malleable. If anybody reads the book or kind of reads the blog or whatever, I think what people take away from it is this very sort of empowering idea, which is that, oh, I too can look at the world in a slightly more inquisitive, challenging way and think about problems and problem solving in a slightly more aggressive way by challenging conventional wisdom, by looking for data to answer questions and so on. So it's not as though we birthed some great movement that's going to actually improve people's lives materially in any way, but it does feel nice to have written a book that people can kind of collaborate on the ideas as they go forward.
Right. I agree. It's altered a lot of people's thinking, which of course is the whole point. How did you all come up with the book title?
That was a stroke of genius by Steve Levitt's sister, whose name is Linda Gines, and who lives in Minnesota. So we were, I don't know if we were done with the book, close to done. We had this manuscript, and it was really getting time to have a title, because the publisher puts out a catalog. And we were pretty stymied, because the book is really about nothing in particular. There's no unifying theme or central idea, really. And so whenever we tried to give it a title that would sort of summarize what the book is about, which is, you know, interesting stories that are illustrations of a bunch of academic research done by an economist at the University of Chicago as filtered through, you know, the narrative stories collected by a New York Times journalist. Any title that would kind of convey that was just either inaccurate or deadly boring. And so we gave this manuscript to Levitt's sister, who'd worked in publishing and advertising. And she came up with maybe 150, 200 titles. And Levitt and I, both of us, when we saw Freakonomics for the first time, we just laughed and said, man, it is so bad that it might actually be good. It's just so outlandish. And the people who might not be disposed to like this book anyway, in other words, people who are looking for a very serious economic book, they're not going to like the book. They're going to hate the title, but they're not going to like the book anyway. Right. And for people who do kind of, who you do kind of want to signal to them, I mean, that's, and we actually write in the book a good bit about names, children's first names. They're a very kind of powerful signaling device. They're meant to signal something. And in this case, it's meant to signal that, yeah, it's about economics to some degree, but it's also meant to be kind of fun in that it explores what other people might think of as a sort of set of freakish curiosities. And so, you know, after a while, a name that seems very odd or outlandish, you know, think about Oprah, it just becomes like, it becomes what it is. So, you know, I'm guessing that when Oprah Winfrey wanted to have her first show and it was meant to be called Oprah, I'm guessing somebody at some network scratched their head and said, geez, you know, what do you think it'd cost us to get her to call herself Jane instead? You know, Oprah, what kind of thing is that? And then, of course, as it goes on, it becomes an actual benefit.
Right. How about the topic that has produced the most hate mail? And why do you think? You've got a lot of near a third rail items here throughout the book. Which has been the hottest one, do you think?
Yeah, I think, surprisingly to me, by a long shot, it was the stuff about realtors and how realtors, how a listing agent may exploit his or her position and information to encourage the seller to take the first decent offer instead of holding out for an optimal offer. There's a lot in the book that one wouldn't be surprised if it would generate controversy in some quarters. Stuff about the link between legalized abortion and a lowering of the crime rate. Various stuff about black-white income and education gaps. Stuff about black and white names. Cheating teachers. I wouldn't have been surprised to hear from a lot of teachers or teachers union folks. But oddly enough, it was the realtors by a long shot from whom we've heard the most aggressively. And honestly, I think if I were a realtor, I would be very unhappy with the book too, because to me it illustrates, I hope not in a nasty way and not in an aggressively, not in a hostile way at all. It illustrates one way in which the way that real estate, that realtors' commission sales are set up right now, often does not serve the best interest of the customer. So if I were a realtor, I wouldn't be happy that this were being exposed either. So, you know, I can't say that's all that surprising. Plus, there's an awful lot of realtors in this country. The entry barrier is very, very low. And so there's, you know, there's several million people out there who are at, in a position to want to be mad about that.
We pause this week's podcast to bring you bankruptcy in the news. Bankruptcy filings for the first three quarters of 2006 are at their lowest levels in nearly 20 years, dropping off by nearly 1 million from the similar period in 2005. Data released Tuesday by the Administrative Office of the U.S. Courts showed that total new filings fell below 444,000 for the first 9 months of 2006. Filings have not been that low since the first three quarters of 1987, when bankruptcy filings totaled just under 433,000. Consumer filings for the first 9 months of 2006 were just under 430,000. This figure represents a 69% decrease from the same period in 2005, when consumer bankruptcies totaled nearly 1.4 million as consumers rushed to file after Congress passed the new law. Business bankruptcies maintained their record low pace as more than 14,000 cases were recorded during the first three quarters of 2006. Business filings for 2006 are on track to be the lowest recorded since consumer and business bankruptcies started being tracked separately in 1980. Nearly a 46% decrease from the same period in 2005, the drop-off in business filings for the first 9 months of 2006 could also be attributable to a healthy U.S. economy, as well as business access to low-interest rate capital. Despite the low bankruptcy filing numbers, panelists testifying Wednesday at the Senate Judiciary's Subcommittee on Administrative Oversight and the Court's oversight hearing on the implementation of the new bankruptcy law said that it was still too early to indicate whether the requirements of the new law were effective. This has been John Hartgen of the ABI. Thank you for listening, and now back to this week's podcast.
Yeah, there's a lot of stuff in here that would get you protests at the least, or pies in the face on college campuses among those who are less tolerant, perhaps.
So. I don't know. What's a, for instance? What do you think we should take a? What do you think would be something to?
Well, I have a variant here, which I want to run by you. And in the original sort of New York Times piece you did on Leavitt, which led to the, I guess, creation of the book, you wrote about his work on abortion's relationship to the lower crimes. You just referred to that. Now, when other people more recently, like Bill Bennett, tried a variant of that,
right,
adding race into the mix as an element, he just got creamed.
Well, I think what Bennett did, and honestly, I feel bad for him because, well, for a couple of reasons. I think his point was misunderstood. Now, I think his point was not to sound racist at all, obviously.
Right.
I think his point, from the best I could divine, was that he's trying to say, do not, he said he didn't want to be a party to the idea of taking an argument that most people would construe as a kind of moral or religious argument, which is the right to abortion or not, and turn that into a utilitarian argument,
right,
which is, even though I may not like it, it produces a social good. I think that was his argument. As a means of illustrating the argument, he then said, well, I'm paraphrasing here, something along the lines of, well, if you really wanted to lower crime, you could just abort every black child in the U.S.
Right.
And that would do it. Now, that's problematic on a couple fronts. First of all, it's unclear why he's signaling now black kids to abort if you want to lower crime, because if you abort any kind of kid, if you abort all of any kid, you're going to lower crime, because then you're just talking about a kind of a selective genocide. Are there different crime rates within different races? Yeah, there are. Is that what Bennett was trying to illustrate? I guess it was. But the other problem with what he said was that he made it sound as though we, and because he referred to Freakonomics in
right.
his argument, he made it sound as if we were advocating some sort of governmental intervention into selective abortion, which is the furthest thing from the argument we were making. The argument we were making is that people respond to incentives and they make choices based on those. The story of Roe v. Wade and crime that we tell seems to be that when women have an option to have a legal abortion, and as opposed to having a child who is unwanted, an unwanted child who is disproportionately more likely to lead a criminal life eventually, because there's a lot of pieces that go along with being unwanted, single parenthood, low education, and so on, that will often contribute to criminality. When a mother has a choice between those two things and she chooses abortion, well, it turns out that the pool of unwanted children shrinks, and therefore the pool of potential criminals shrinks. That's, I guess you could mistake that for a utilitarian argument, but that's very much, we very much didn't make a utilitarian argument in the book. In fact, we went to the extent to say that even if you think that abortion is the greatest crime-fighting tool you've ever heard of, you should then look at the numbers, because if you do, you'll see that as a crime-fighting tool, it would be horribly inefficient. In other words, the number of children that are aborted each year to produce the commensurate lowered rate of crime, that the ratio is very, very high. And so we, you know, kind of bent over backwards, knowing that this is a sensitive subject on many fronts, to lay out the argument in a way that no matter how you feel about abortion per se, and it seems as though everybody feels fairly strongly about it in some direction, you could understand that what we're saying was not an advocacy of any position, but rather trying to explain a condition that happened, which is this is a country that went from very few legal abortions each year to very many, and then you want to look at the consequences, unintended or otherwise, of that change.
Well, here's my spin on it, and you can tell me whether or not this is either plausible or measurable. It's similar, but I don't think I'm in the Bill Bennett end of the pool here. But here's my theory, and I'm not sure I've seen this anywhere in print, at least. But 30 years of unrestricted access to abortion, my theory is this has been bad politically for Democrats, and not in the way that you think, just as a policy matter, because more people might be.
Let me guess, you're getting rid of future Democratic voters, right?
Exactly.
Right.
Exactly. There are 20 million fewer potential voters today than there would otherwise be, and that these would-be people, given, again, the likely political demographics of their putative mothers, and that's also something similar that you had in your crime chapter, would be more likely to have been Democrats, thus suppressing their vote count in national and statewide elections. And I think further that at least at a minimum, I think Al Gore would be president today if our national abortion law were the status quo ante Roe v. Wade. Now, does that make the Freakonomics supplemental edition?
It makes, on the surface, it makes a lot of sense. And that argument has been put forth by a couple people. The only guy I know by name who put it forth is James Taranto at the Wall Street Journal, who's not an academic as far as I know. And he called it something like, can't remember what it's called now, the Democratic, the abortion voting effect or something.
If I plagiarized somebody, I apologize.
So, no, I don't think you plagiarized. I think you thought of the idea organically, which makes a lot of sense. I did see a little bit of academic response to it that argued that it is not true. On what grounds that measurement concluded it isn't true, I don't know, because I just don't know the literature. It would seem to make sense on some levels, but like I said, the only bit of academic research I've seen that rolls it up seems to think not, whether that's because people mistake fertility rate among Dems and GOP families. I'm not really sure what it is.
I'm thinking you know, single mothers, single parents, people who perhaps are have more education. The demographics of the profile of the kind of urban or slightly ex-urban Democrat voter, they're going to be more likely to be in favor of abortion rights. They're going to be vote for Democrats. If they are in the pool.
The variables here, but there's a lot of moving variables at once. That's the problem. That's why, so when you first preface it with how easy it is to measure, I think the answer is it's going to be really hard to measure. It may not be impossible, but it's going to be hard. One fact you have to consider, that I would consider off the top of my head, is the fact that even in a presidential election, voter turnout is 52 to 55%.
Right.
So half the people aren't voting at all.
Right.
If you're making the argument that the families that are having especially low income, low educated parents who might be Dems and who are having abortions and are preventing future Dem voters, well, the very same argument kind of works against you, because that profile is also the kind of person who's a lot less likely to vote. So I don't know. It's a great question. I'd love to hear an answer or come up with the answer ourselves one day. I think the political piece of that issue is also a really interesting one, which is what has been the benefit or penalty of, for both parties, and again, this is hard to measure, but what's been the cost or benefit for both parties of making abortion for much of the last 30 years the dividing line, the litmus test in their politics and to some degree in policy. So what's interesting is in this recent midterm election, what we saw was a very unusual crossing over. You're seeing pro-choice Republicans more and more, not much, but a little bit, and pro-life Dems. So it's very interesting to see how the issue seems at long last to be abating a little bit as the dividing line. And I think this presidential election, you know, I'm in New York, so I pay a little bit more attention to Hillary Clinton and Rudy Giuliani. Giuliani is a guy who's been pro-choice his entire political career, and he's going to run maybe as a Republican.
Right.
Hillary Clinton, about a year and a half ago, began talking to pro-life groups and others, repeating the words of the wish of her husband as president, who said, you know, let's make abortion safe, legal, and rare. You know, so there's a real change in the way that abortion is seen as both a kind of religious moral issue and particularly, I think, as a political issue.
Well, I don't think her NARAL ratings are in any jeopardy, notwithstanding that
well,
statement.
Well, I don't know. In some ways, the left or the pro-choice movement, I think, is I don't think anybody is in a hurry to embrace this theory of Levitt's, this research that Levitt did with John Donahue,
right,
that shows a link between abortion and crime. Because as I mentioned, no matter how you feel about abortion, it's a jarring idea.
Nobody wants those two things in the same sense.
Exactly.
Uh-huh. Yeah. Well, you know, maybe again for your for Freakonomics too.
Super Freakonomics.
Super Freakonomics. part two. How about you know, in our area, we have always, I get this question all the time from the media about whether or not there is a reduction in bankruptcy stigma.
Uh-huh.
And of course, you know, there's no way to measure that empirically. People who go through bankruptcy, personal bankruptcy, certainly don't feel good about it. But it's a very, you know, it's a very personal thing. They would be, you know, much more, they'd be happier if they could, you know, pay their bills on time and didn't have economic problems, didn't have medical problems, didn't have family problems, which led to them, you know, needing to think about bankruptcy as a measure of relief. But you know, we heard a lot during the 9 years of debate over the bankruptcy bill about, you know, there being a kind of destigmatization of bankruptcy, which led to the explosion in bankruptcy filings, which peaked, you know, last year at 2 million cases and ultimately pushed the new bill over the goal line. So that's another one I want you guys to dig into. Is there anything left to the what was once a generational stigma, moral stigma attached to personal bankruptcy, a sort of a personal failure? Is there anything left to that, you know, in an era where, Macy's goes bankrupt and every airline goes bankrupt and companies and or counties and states and cities go bankrupt, and you know, nobody appears to, you know, alter their behavior at all.
Yeah, that's a great. I mean, it's a great question. Not just, you know, for you, it's a good question because it's your arena. It's exactly the kind of question that we're working on now in
research.
So, so basically, you know, one answer to the question of how you could measure that, you know, whether it's a kind of reluctance or stigma toward the idea of it or the very word bankruptcy and so on. You know, one thing that we are doing some work on now and are kind of advocates of in a way is experimentation for businesses. So, for instance, you know, every business is involved in all these different efforts, marketing and, you know, some kind of production, whatever, all these different things you're doing. And the problem is that people try to look at cause and effect with just maybe one or two variables and one or two data points and so on. And especially when it's something concerning ROI, it's very important to know what kind of return you're getting on what kind of investment, but it's also very hard. So marketing and advertising, for instance, are arenas that are really ripe for this. For years and years and years and years, advertising was kind of devoid of any ROI requirements. And look, it supports entire industries. Journalism would not exist. Network TV would not exist were it not for the idea, the belief that advertising in a very general sense for a car, a bottle of beer, an insurance contract will appeal to enough people who happen to see it that they'll take action on it. So again, it's hard to measure the effectiveness of something like that if you're just trying something and sitting back and seeing how business goes, because there's all these other moving parts at the same time. So what we're trying to do is working with a variety of firms, most of them pretty small, to do some little randomized experiments within their operations. So whether it's a solicitation letter from a charity, or whether it's an advertising program for an electronics store, we are setting up some little randomized experiments within those. So we'll divide them up into four different campaigns and alter language, alter frequency, alter something. And then with all other things being held equal, you can really measure the effect of these small changes and see what happens. So with bankruptcy, what would be very interesting is to come up with a way, whether it's through advertising, whether it's through direct marketing, whether it's through press relations, whatever it is, lobbying, to try across a spectrum different ways of presenting material and try to really measure the impact of how people feel about the word, how people feel about the concept, what kind of things that change their feelings about it, whether it matters, you know, the degrees to which the method of approach, the timing of approach, the season of approach change. So, you know, I think for you guys, it's a very important question to answer. I would start to go about it by that way. It's a very simplistic approach, but we find that a lot of hard problems are virtually impossible to solve. And so the best that we can do is kind of come up with these very simple approaches that nibble around the edges of the problem, and at least you kind of gain a foothold sometimes.
Well, if you can come up with something on that question, we would definitely want to have you back, and it would definitely answer a lot of questions that we get here. Stephen, we wish you continued great success with Freakonomics, not that you need it, and any future projects that you plan. And thank you so much for joining us today on ABI Podcast.
Okay, Sam, my pleasure. Thanks very much.
And with that, this is ABI Executive Director Sam Giordano saying goodbye for ABI Podcast. See you next time.